Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. This is the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio, nestled in among all those shows that help you to think through your faith. And coming up straight after Unbelievable today, you can hear The Profile. Sam Hales, Deputy Editor of Premier Christianity Magazine, will be in conversation with Telegraph leader, writer and Catholic Tim Stanley. He's someone who's very active on Twitter. I follow him. I think he's been on the show before as well, Unbelievable. So you may want to tune in for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And The Profile is, of course, available as a podcast too, as is, of course, Unbelievable. Here on the show, we get Christians and non-Christians talking on a regular basis. Today, though, a little bit different. I'll be introducing my two guests because actually neither of them are Christians today. We're talking about out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences on the programme today. We'll have some of your feedback later on in the show. I've just come back from quite a long summer break and a number of episodes of Unbelievable aired in my absence, and a whole load of emails have stacked up as well. So we'll get to some of those. Some more news on the Unbelievable book available now, as well as the audio book available, of course, via Audible and our own website as well. That's all available from unbelievablebook.co.uk. Those signed copies available from our own website, proving very popular, actually. So do go there if you'd like a signed copy of the book, telling the story of this show and why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. Unbelievablebook.co.uk. Time to get into today's programme.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, how do we explain out-of-body experiences? On today's show, I'm joined by psychologist Susan Blackmore, author of the newly released book, Seeing Myself, The New Science of Out-of-Body Experiences. It's a book that charts Sue's own interest in out-of-body experiences, henceforth OBEs, and since she had one herself as a student, actually, to becoming convinced eventually that there's actually nothing supernatural going on, but that the brain alone and its surroundings, if you like, produce the strange experiences involved. And we'll hear some of those strange experiences on the programme today. Many do still hold that out-of-body and near-death experiences defy naturalistic explanation. Researchers such as Penny Sartori claim there's clear evidence that people who have OBEs can give details of people, places and situations that they couldn't otherwise possibly have known without their consciousness somehow leaving their body. Graham Nichols is my other guest on today's show. He's an author and researcher for the Rhine Research Center in the USA. His books include Avenues of the Human Spirit and Navigating the Out-of-Body Experience. He says that OBEs really do occur and can't be explained by brain activity alone. He says he's had numerous out-of-body experiences himself in which he witnessed places and details that he couldn't possibly have known about otherwise. And he continues to research and dialogue on the issue today. So that's our debate today. How do we explain out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences as well? Unusually, actually, for Unbelievable today, neither of my contributors are Christians. Normally, it's a Christian and non-Christian sitting down with me. And there are certainly some Christians working in this area, people like Gary Habermas, David Bentley Hart, looking at consciousness and OBEs. But today, we're really actually pitting Sue's, I suppose you could call it, and we'll come to define these terms in a minute, naturalistic view of out-of-body experiences against Graham's view that they are evidence that there's more going on than skeptics like Sue believe. So welcome along to the programme, Susan and Graham.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's great to have you both, and it's great to be able to be here filming today's show as well as recording it for broadcast on the radio. So I will just say, if you're listening as a regular radio or podcast listener, check out the videos too, which will be alongside this programme on the website at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I've had you on the programme usually by phone in the past, Sue, so it's lovely
That's
to
right.
have you join me
yeah,
in person today. Thank you for coming in. Because this book really is the end of, well, not the end maybe, but it's certainly the story so far of a long journey you've been on in this whole area. How did you get into out-of-body experiences and this rather esoteric world?
You're right. I hope it's not the end. I have a few years left, but it has been very strange because I wrote my first book about out-of-body experiences back in, well, it was published in 1982. And now why am I writing another one all this time later? Because finally the science is catching up, which really we didn't know anything that helped to understand OBEs back then. But why did it all start? It started with my own experience when I was a student. I was 19. It was my first term at university. I was excited by everything, not getting enough sleep, you know. And that the particular night it happened, I'd been with some friends messing around with a Ouija board, which is not something I would recommend because I don't think spirits are involved, but I think it involves a lot of psychology that can be quite unhelpful.
Okay.
Anyway, so we're sat there, you know, with our arms out on a with a glass, moving around with the letters on the, you know, on the table for hours. And that does make you a bit kind of trancy and weird. And I was really tired as well.
Yeah.
And I went up to a friend's room to have a smoke of cannabis. Remember, this is 1970.
Yes, yes.
So this was kind of, you know, the end of the hippie era. There I was in my hippie clothes and, you know.
Has much changed, let's be honest?
Well, I think my hair's improved, but as for the rest, I don't know, a bit tame these days. But anyway, and I'm a granny. I mean, I should have changed
times
a bit.
Times do change, yes.
Anyway, back so there I was, to going my going back to these old days. And I was sitting on the floor, cross-legged, listening to music, and I wish I could remember what it was. I'd written it down, but it was probably Pink Floyd or Grateful Dead or
something
something
trippy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I sat down and I was like, you know, I had one puff of this joint and I thought, I feel a bit weird. And I felt a bit floaty. And then I started going down the tunnel. Now, remember, this is 1970. The term near-death experience had not been invented by then. That came in 1975 with Moody's famous book, Life After Life. And I'd never heard of tunnel experiences, but there I was going down this tunnel of trees towards a bright light. And I was like, wow, you know, I mean, I was just going down a tunnel, lovely music going, you know. Yeah. And then my friend asked me, where are you, Sue? Now, that is a very weird question, isn't it? You know, where am I? Well, I had to think, where am I? And I couldn't say, even though he was a good friend, I couldn't say, I'm going down a tunnel towards a light. And I thought, where am I? I'm in Vicky's room. I must sort my, you know.
Yeah.
So and I was all drifty and floaty. And it was just as though everything cleared. I'm sure you know what that's like, Graham. Maybe you do too, Justin.
No.
When it just suddenly, everything is clear. And it's as though your vision has never been so clear and wonderful. But I was looking down from the ceiling on us down there below.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I'm on the ceiling. I could see the body down there with the mouth moving and saying, you know, talking. And I think, I mean, I knew subsequently that most OBEs only last a few seconds, up to a very few minutes. And I think I would have just kind of panicked and gone back to normal if it hadn't been for Kevin going on saying, oh, what can you see? What can you do? Have you got a silver cord?
He
just kept talking. Yeah. And I went out and travelled around. I don't want to tell the whole story. Perhaps we can come back to some aspects of it. But it ultimately turned into a kind of mystical experience. And I'd never even heard of those in those days.
Wow.
Of just oneness, of the disintegration of self into the universe. And, I, you know, just imagine a 19-year-old student studying physiology and psychology, cutting up rat brains and running pigeons and rats in mazes and pigeons pressing levers. And, you know, there was nothing in the science that was around then to have any understanding at all. So I thought all that stuff is so, you know, materialistic and these closed-minded scientists teaching me, they don't realize there's all this beyond, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why I decided to become a parapsychologist,
On this journey.
That's right. That was the beginning.
Now, obviously, you'll have to cut a very long story short here.
Yeah, and I'm talking too much already.
But no, it's fine. But it's fascinating stuff. In the end, you went into a lot of these parapsychology studies, looking into whether there is evidence for the paranormal and so on. And in the end, despite, I think, probably being very open to that
from the
beginning,
I was.
You felt the evidence didn't lead you in that direction ultimately.
I was more than open. In fact, it was rather closed. I was, okay. I know, because I've been there right. and I've seen it. So I know that it's true that my spirit left yes. my body. That's yes. what I thought at the time.
Yeah.
So that, yes, I went into the parapsychology and I did 4 years of a PhD with lots and lots of experiments on telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, so on. I slept in I don't know how many haunted houses and never met a ghost and on and on and on. And I never found any convincing evidence. And I had some very depressing examples of working very, very hard to try to understand why somebody else was getting good results and I wasn't. In one case only, I found fraud. Other times I found just there wasn't enough evidence to be sure or wrong statistics, but it's terribly hard work.
Did you ever try to reproduce your own experience again?
Oh, yes. Well, that's another whole thing. Mm. Yes, I did, but never with that amazing success. Right. But I can induce kind of sketchy,
something.
Brief,
yeah, sure.
you know,
yeah.
sort of very simple out-of-body experience, but nothing like that. I suspect that that requires a combination of things and a kind of ignorance in which it's all such a shock and a surprise. And you know, anyway, I did all those experiments and didn't find any evidence, but that doesn't prove that there couldn't be any.
Yeah.
So I kept on and on and on and on for years and years and years. All I can say is I'm as convinced as I can be, which is not 100%, but as convinced as I can be that there are no paranormal phenomena, pending evidence. I mean,
and as you say, you write the book now because you believe that the science has caught up with
yes.
why the brain can give an adequate explanation for how these kinds of experiences happen and are induced and
yeah,
so on,
yeah.
which will be good to hear about, obviously. We'll maybe save that for a little bit later yeah. in the conversation. And introduce our other guest on the programme today, Graeme Nichols, who has been on the show before. I think it was in conversation with Eben Alexander about his particular near-death experience, and also Jane Aspel, who's a neuroscientist who obviously takes a more materialistic understanding of these things. I'm sure you're familiar perhaps with some of her work as well, Sue. But Graeme, you've got a really interesting backstory as well. So let's hear that now, because you've been having, on a somewhat regular basis, out-of-body experiences for some time. When did it begin, though, and give us some examples of what these were like?
Well, the very first ones were when I was about 12 years old. They were very uncharacteristic, actually, of the standard form of out-of-body experience, because I found myself nowhere near my body, actually something like 500 metres from where I lived, and in an upright position.
Normally these are sort of looking down more.
The classic right. description is being above the body, looking right. down. But my first few experiences, very fleeting, they were short, only it's hard to say now, obviously, memory is fallible and it was a very long time ago.
But these weren't
ago.
Like daydreams, they were something quite...
No, they were very... they felt physical. They right. felt like I was literally at another place
yes.
and floating maybe kind of this amount off the ground. And I would find myself there, I would look around, everything was very vivid, and then it would end very quickly. And I had a few of these. I had never heard of out-of-body experiences, astral projection, any of these ideas. My parents aren't religious or interested in anything like this, so I had no reference point for it. But then essentially a few months later, I think it must have been, I heard the term out-of-body experience, and I went out to try and find more about it, and I came across a book by a parapsychologist called Janet Lee Mitchell called Out of Body Experiences, right. a Handbook, which was looking at Ingo Swann and some of the sort of famous names. Sue will know who I'm talking
yes.
about.
Yeah.
And I read that book and became more interested in trying to induce it for myself.
And that's, I think, the interesting thing as well, is people, I guess, often assume out-of-body experiences are somehow thrust upon someone, you know, or at a near-death experience or something, whereas, in your opinion, you can actually bring them on yourself. So how does that happen, firstly, briefly, and give us an example of one which you think gave you evidence that something was genuinely happening in which you were seeing things that you couldn't possibly have seen from
Well, the first one that convinced me, well, not convinced me, but gave me a piece of evidence that there was something objective to the experience, took place near Bayswater Road. I was coming around the corner of Marble Arch and started going down Bayswater Road.
Here in London.
Yeah, here in London. And then I moved off down towards Lancaster Road, which was a road I'd never been to at the time, which is kind of relevant to this. And I moved into first floor window of a house, and there was some paperwork. This was in the sort of early 90s, no internet kind of thing. So there was some letterhead paper laid out on a desk.
So you were seeing this in the experience?
I saw certain details. See, it wasn't the entire thing. I didn't see everything that was on the letterhead paper. I saw specific details. When I was moving along the street, I saw the sign, you know, the postcode sign with the street on it. But I remember seeing the W11, which was the postcode for the area, but I didn't... It was like my vision
zoomed in. Just to be clear then, where were you actually at the time you were having the out-of-body experience?
I was on the other side of London, laying in my bedroom.
Right, because so that's the important thing. You were having an out-of-body experience in one part of London, which you felt was you walking down a certain street in another part of... going through a window of a particular residence and seeing...
It was like
a desk
office
with the paraphernalia of an office desk on it, and a particular letterhead on the paper and so on. All very strange. What made you think that was an objective experience, though?
Well, because I was able to get the name of the person. I saw the name at the top of the letterhead, and also, as I said, as I was going, I saw the W11 on the road sign.
And you wrote that down after you came out of the out-of-body experience?
Yeah, and then I looked it up in the phone book and found that there was a person at that address with that name.
Go and introduce yourself?
That's a funny story. I actually did phone him up, and then I kind of chickened out at the last minute, which is a bit of a shame.
What did you say when you phoned?
Well, I didn't. That was the thing. He answered the phone, I was like, what am I going to say?
You know? I'm just going to sound like a complete weirdo to him.
Yeah,
this man.
Exactly. Right. And he phoned back right away as well, but didn't answer.
But you established that this person that you had seen the details of in the on the letterhead and so on did live at this address,
and what I saw, as far as I could ascertain, I didn't obviously go into the house, but the outside of the house matched as I'd seen in the experience.
All right, give us one more, and again I'll ask you to be brief. There's one fascinating one you detail in one of your books about a church that you sort of visited again in this sort of out-of-body experience, saw details of broken windows and so on, which you later went and checked out and turned out to be the case.
Yeah, that was a recent one because I essentially wanted to give an example. A lot of people were talking about veridical out-of-body experiences, and I wanted to give an example of quite an ordinary one in a sense, not a really grand, spectacular one. I want something that was quite everyday sort of details. Yes. And in the experience, I went up and over the top of the Alexander Nevsky Cathedral, which is on the far side of Tallinn.
This is in Estonia, where
I live. And I came down from the roof, and I could see that there was damage to two of the windows, with specific coloured tape and tarpaulin, yellow tape and tarpaulin and things like that, which I noted down to avoid confirmation bias and that kind of thing. Also told my partner, and you know, and then before we went and checked anything out, so to try and exclude any possibility of bias. And
when you did go and check it out, the details all matched.
Yeah,
what you
in every detail, and there was nothing left out as well. There was no, you know, altering things a little bit to fit.
So I'm really interested to hear what Sue makes of these experiences in a moment. But just to round this off, what happens when you go into this out-of-body experience, and how do you induce it in the first place?
Well, I take a very multi-leveled approach. I use mild sensory deprivation. I use all kinds of meditational practices. I use mental focus, self-hypnosis, a whole combination of different things. I've even worked with virtual reality. So I use different approaches to try and create a conducive condition for the experience to happen.
And there's just a moment at which something flips somewhere in your consciousness, and
yeah,
suddenly
it's,
you're floating.
It's hard to explain. I don't do it. Some people assume it's through sleep, but I don't do it through sleep. It's more of a, I guess, something like a trance.
A waking experience. Fascinating stuff. So when
presented with something like what we just heard there from Graham, what's your immediate reaction to that? I mean, do you just assume it's anecdotal, you must have misremembered, or possibly you've got some memory stored way back of knowing that the cathedral's windows were out of order, and you're just projecting that. Where
all
do you
those
go?
Thoughts okay. and many more.
Yes.
You know, part of me is thinking, wow. Yeah. We have to remember that if this is possible, if yes. it is possible to go and see something the other side of town that you couldn't possibly have known, like somebody's name, and you get it right, most of science has to be overthrown. Now, that's big deal.
Yeah.
That's not to say that it couldn't happen, because smaller parts of science are constantly, science is a process of constantly having a theory that's, you know, not too bad, but then something makes it move on and question, and it's always changing. But on the whole, we don't overthrow, you know, Newton's laws of motion or Darwin's theory of evolution yeah. or whatever. I mean, these things are so well established. Nevertheless, it's possible. It would be so dramatic if it were true. So part of me is thinking, wow, I want to get him and do some experiments, and I'll put something in the, you know, like the experiments I used to do all those decades ago.
Right.
And I did lots and lots with people who claimed to have out-of-body experiences. I mean, they had out-of-body experiences. They claimed to be able to come to my house, and I would put targets for years. I put targets in my kitchen for people to come and see.
But it never... Only
twice in all those years did somebody write and say, we're going pre-internet as well, write me a letter and say, I saw it. Only twice, and they were both wrong.
Right.
So, you know, a part of me is saying, oh, it's still possible, it's still possible. Another part is going, as you had said, well, you know, he may have walked past that cathedral or any number of things. What typically happens is people will describe something, but... You know, how much detail can you give? You know, was the tape on the window like that or like that and so on? So I'm very interested in how apparently true things get mixed with not.
Yeah.
I mean, in my own experience, clear as my vision was, and as it felt realer than ordinary life at the time, you know, and I still remember it.
Yeah.
But as I went out of the building, I tried to check. I looked at all the chimneys and the gutters and the downpipes and things on the outside of my college that I thought, I could check them the next day.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were all wrong. Right. So it was completely convincing. There weren't any chimneys on this building.
Right.
And the gutters were plastic, white plastic, not, you know, the old...
Fashioned
side. Yeah, exactly. Iron ones.
So you were seeing something that was very realistic, but it wasn't actually what... in fact existed.
Well, to a large extent it was, because I knew the college well, and I went off over Oxford and I knew the way, and, you know, flew, I knew the streets and everything. As Graham probably did with London, you knew some parts, but you've said that you knew Bayswater Road, but you didn't know Lancaster Road or whatever.
Before we get Graham to come back then with maybe his justification for why he does think that it was a objectively true experience, I mean, what is going on in the brain, as far as you're concerned, when someone like Graham experiences this and maybe arrives at it through this process of a bit of self-hypnosis, sensory deprivation?
Yeah, you have to get into particular special...
Yeah.
Yes, you do. Well, what changed everything from my point of view was in 2002, when a neurosurgeon called Olaf Blanke discovered, more or less by accident, that there's a spot on the right temporoparietal junction. So that's on the right side of the brain where the temporal lobes and the parietal lobes meet. And he discovered that he had an epileptic patient with electrodes all over the surface of her brain, and he was stimulating different places to see if he could find where to operate to alleviate the seizures. And he found that he could induce and control out-of-body experiences by stimulating this spot.
Right.
Now, that was a real world-changing discovery, if you like, because it allowed us to home in on what's going on. Now, of course, there are some people, Melvin Morse and other people I'm sure you know about, who would say things like they did with the God spot. Ah, that's where God communicates with us.
Right.
That's where the spirit comes out of, you know, whatever.
Okay.
And one can't argue against that unless one has some kind of understanding of what's happening in that bit of the brain. Mm. And what is? Ah, it's right central in the whole self-constructing mechanism of the brain. So if you think of yourself as a kind of a spirit or a soul, how does it communicate with the brain? What we're learning all the time now is how the brain constructs what I would say an illusion of a self. So this is much more like a Buddhist or early Hindu idea than a Christian or Jewish or Islamic view, that it's an illusion if we think of ourselves as a kind of thing in there, yes. looking out through the eyes. What's really happening is that bit of the brain is building a body schema, which is like, where are my arms and legs? So right now you've got you can feel the things you're on your hands there. You can feel you're leaning against the back of the chair.
I've got an awareness of my posture and everything.
Exactly, all of that. Yeah. And that's all down there at the TPJ on the right side. And from there it's integrated with memories and so on to build up our fuller sense of self. So now you think, well, why should stimulating that cause an out-of-body experience? It starts to make sense because you're disrupting the body schema. And one of the interesting things that fell out of this, there's loads more, but I'll just finish with this bit, that comes out of this is that you would also expect with lighter stimulation, Blanky found you get body distortions. Your legs get longer or shorter, or you seem to get bigger or smaller, which I did in my experience too. And interestingly, I went back over all those wonderful old, you know, Muldoon and Carrington and all the early astral projection literature and Iram and Oliver Fox, and they all describe body distortions. They all describe things like being stretched and pulled and just the kind of things you get when you stimulate that area only a little bit. That's just one little nugget of stuff falling into place.
This is obviously going to be, you know, we're scratching the surface on this inevitably.
But I can just make one point, this is what's given me such joy and brought me back after all those years of going, I want nothing to do with it, I've had enough of it, brought me back because, you know, you delve in, you find some more, you ask another question, you find some more, and that's why I'm so excited.
But all of it has obviously served to confirm the view that it is all happening in the brain, that there is no objective actual fact of being able to see into other places and spaces and so on. We're going to come back to this in just a moment, Graham, because I'm sure you're desperate to have your say in response to this. But we're already at the end of our first section. The time flies.
You'll have to tell me to talk less.
No, it's fine. These things sometimes take a little while to explain and set out. So that's what we're talking about today on the show, though, out-of-body experiences. My guests are Graham Nichols, who's someone who believes that there are objective evidence for out-of-body experiences. He has them himself, and he's already explained one or two he's had. Whereas Susan Blackmore, whose new book, Seeing Myself, The New Science of Out-of-Body Experiences, charts her own journey in this whole area, has been explaining why she thinks that it can be explained by the way that our brain operates and gives us a sense of self, and that what's happening in an out-of-body experience is a sort of disruption of that mechanism. And we're going to be hearing the conversation as we continue on today's show between Graham and Susan. So do stay with us here on Unbelievable. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Hello and welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. On Unbelievable today, we're talking about out-of-body experiences. If you want to get in touch with the show, by the way, you can do that by emailing in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be interested to hear what you think of today's subject. It's a bit more esoteric, you could say, than we normally go here on the show, but I think it's a fascinating area. And in a sense, the two guests I have on breaking the rules of the show a little bit. It's actually not a Christian and a non-Christian. Both my guests wouldn't claim to have any Christian beliefs per se, but they still have a really interesting difference of opinion on this particular area, which does of course intersect with claims of the supernatural at some level. And so we're talking today on the show to Susan Blackmore, or Sue as she more commonly known to friends, author of a newly released book, Seeing Myself, The New Science of Out-of-Body Experiences. And we've heard how she had a profound out-of-body experience as a student. But after years of research and looking for the evidence to back it up, she had to conclude that actually it's in the brain. That's what produces these experiences. People aren't actually, their consciousness isn't actually floating elsewhere and able to see other things.
On the other hand, Graham Nichols, author and researcher for the Ryan Research Centre in the USA and the author of a couple of books, has been describing some of his out-of-body experiences and why he does believe they give objective evidence for the fact that something is going on, something beyond what Sue believes is happening. I mean, let's return to some of the objections that Sue had there, Graham. I mean, specifically question marks over whether it couldn't be possible that some of those experiences you described could be something that was going on somewhere in the background, something you maybe half remembered but didn't remember, but that might explain how you were able to have these experiences that were then confirmed later by going to see that place and so on. And also just this fact that isn't it a rather high bar that you're attempting to traverse here, overthrowing all of standard science in a sense to say something's going on beyond a kind of purely naturalistic phenomenon here?
I guess, well, first off, the thing about the different experiences, we gave one example, yeah. The same as Sue gave one example. I think that my opinion is based on many experiences that I've had personally, then a review of the parapsychology, then a review of near-death studies, all of these different areas coming together. I'm not basing my viewpoint on
just off your own
just on one sure. experience yeah, yeah. or even two experiences. Mm. I'm basing it on a whole body of experiences, some of which could not be explained by peripheral visions or remembering things incorrectly or anything like that. So it depends on which experience yeah. we focus on. And then we have to go into the science then, and we have to look at things like Patricio Trisaldi's research, for example.
What's
which
that?
Is the most current research looking at the objectivity of out-of-body experiences. And with independent judges, that research found 66.7% in favour of the out-of-body experiences seeing correctly while they were out-of-body. That study used hypnosis to induce the out-of-body experiences, was in a controlled context, and gave strong evidence for out-of-body experiences, extremely statistically significant. So when you actually look at the science and you combine it with the experiences people have and you look at near-death studies, you have a complete body of evidence.
As Sue says, would it overthrow standard science in your view?
No, I think that many scientists I've discussed this with, including Brian Josephson, who's a Nobel laureate in physics, doesn't feel that we would have to overthrow everything. He feels that we would have to maybe extend things or add elements to a wider scheme of how science operates.
Because I've purposely not used the phrase supernatural in regards to what you believe about these things, because I don't think you yourself would be comfortable with that phrase. I think your view is that, well, if it happens, then it's part of the natural order of things. It's just we have to expand our understanding of what is included in that sphere of the natural.
Sure.
Sense.
I think there's many things in science that we don't fully understand at this point. We have certain ideas about them. We have certain evidence that they exist, but we haven't explained how they function and what's right. what's going on.
Well, consciousness is the most obvious example.
Yeah.
Left behind all the parapsychology I used to do and thought, well, the real deep mystery is consciousness. How does a brain that we know is made of, neurons and chemicals and electrical, ions going across membranes and all that, how does that make this happen?
This thing we experience of sight, touch, smell.
Yeah. And we don't know anything but sight, touch, smell. But, we only know brains through sight, touch, smell, There's a big mystery, and I don't dismiss that at all.
I mean, but for you, are you going on the working assumption, let's say, that it is ultimately reducible to those chemicals and neurons and grey matter?
But deep down, dualism, I believe dualism, the sense of mind and matter being completely separate things, can't be right.
Right.
And in deep mystical experiences and in prayer...
But that's not
and
what I'm saying.
No, I know. But it's sort of relevant to this point.
To what perhaps an average Christian might assume about
yes,
the nature
yes,
of spirit.
Because we can't
matter.
Work out how they could communicate.
Right. Okay.
And yet our whole science is kind of based on that duality.
Yes.
That's why we have the mystery of consciousness, because we talk about matter and then we can't understand consciousness.
Right.
So I think there will be a big... revolution in science, that okay. somehow to bring them together, that the ultimate building blocks of science, we've got it wrong or something like that, but I'm not a physicist. Nevertheless, even if we come to an overthrowing of certain aspects, I don't think, personally, I don't think this would, allow for telepathy and clairvoyance okay. and time, you know.
But a lot of people do think.
Yes,
that.
Yes, yeah, oh, they do, course. The people you've mentioned.
And,
I know Brian Josephson very well.
And scientists,
yeah.
you know.
I mean, let's come back to this. I mean, we want to talk about the actual brain chemistry that Sue's talked about as well, and what you make of that whole explanation. But do you want to just give a couple more examples then from the wider body that you're drawing from of, you know, instances where you think there are pretty, you know, incontrovertible pieces of evidence that someone saw something, was able to recall something that they couldn't possibly have known through just something buried in their psychology somewhere?
I guess the precognitive out-of-body experience I had, which I guess you could also, if precognition's going a bit too far for a lot of people, I think you can also see it possibly in the sense of something like telepathy as well. But essentially, I had an out-of-body experience with four people present when the out-of-body experience happened. I witnessed a terrorist attack that happened in London in 1999 during the out-of-body experience, this is. Came back to my body, described it to everyone who was present in the room, and 5 days later it happened. All the details were recorded within 2 hours of the out-of-body experience happening. And if people are interested, there's even a video online of me describing it and one of the witnesses describing it. So I think that one is pretty hard.
Describing, and this video recorded before the actual event happened?
No, the video was recorded after, okay. but we recorded all the details before, right. before the event yeah. happened.
I mean, I have also heard of, you know, so people have tried to set up actual experiments, as the kind of Sue has been talking about, where there's a sign or some numbers or something going on in a, say, a hospital room where people might often claim to have had a near-death experience. Now, is there any evidence that any of those have ever actually yielded any positive results? Has anyone seen a number on a high ledge that they couldn't possibly have seen from the position they were in the
hospital
room? Well,
I think the signs approach is probably a bit of a dead-end angle. I think Pim van Lommel and myself both were critical of that methodology right. before the study, like the AWARE study, for example, went in that direction. Partly because people in near-death experiences rarely, if ever, describe that kind of thing. They tend to describe, if you look at the major cases, which I'm sure Sue will reference, the trainer and the dentures and those kind of famous cases, it's usually a small three-dimensional object that people are describing. So for a start, I think the type of target that we use needs to be based upon something like that. Then you've also got the problem of why would someone even be interested in looking at a random thing
sure.
while someone's operating on their body. So I think it's not the best kind of approach. But as I mentioned, there is research going on in Italy using targets where the people have been successful with independent judges assessing, which is sort of the gold standard in terms of, you know, even skeptics like Chris French. We use independent judges to avoid bias in terms of selecting which target they think the information matches. And that,
I mean, you're probably familiar with some of this stuff, Sue, obviously. Has any of the research others have done, which
Patricio Trisoldi's research,
which Graham seems to think do yield some sort of a positive?
Yes, I'm afraid that I haven't gone into that in the kind of detail that I would need to do with all the stats and I've not been there to see the lab. Yeah. The trouble is, from my years in parapsychology, I know that to really assess what's going on there, you have to go there and meet the people and see the lab and look at all the things that are going on. And I haven't done that. And this is recent stuff.
Yes.
But you mentioned...
But that's why it's important.
Well, I know it is. Yeah. But you mentioned Dentures Man and the shoe on the ledge in Seattle and all of those.
Yeah, but
places.
Only in terms of the types of things that people are describing. I'm not saying...
They're
very, very old cases. I think we've gone beyond that now. I think there's
okay,
a lot
well, let's take Pim van Lommel's work then, which I go into in some detail in my book, because he's claiming non-local consciousness, consciousness beyond the body, consciousness out in time and so on the basis of studying near-death experiences. And it's kind of worrying, really, because he did the most fantastic, or led a team doing a fantastic study of a prospective study of near-death experiences. That means you specify in advance that you're going to study everybody who's gone in this hospital and had a heart attack or whatever it might be. And he did that and found out how many people had NDEs, how deep the NDEs were, and so on. Very good work. And then he kind of leaps from that to saying, well, this proves non-local consciousness. And analysing that paper, there's things like he says, for example, oh, there's plenty of evidence of blind people being able to see again during NDEs, and puts a little reference. Well, he doesn't actually reference all the criticisms and Ken Ring's book and all the troubles that went on and you know, there really isn't.
You haven't referenced Trisaldi's work at all in your book.
No, because I haven't, you know, I'm afraid
but
when I was writing this...
But that's the most recent research.
Yes,
on the
I know.
Subject.
Well, I will.
Well,
I will.
Well, maybe there'll be an opportunity, you know, as
when
time
I,
goes
when
on
I was
to,
right, you know how
to,
long
to
it takes to publish books. When I was writing that, that
research
didn't
was ongoing.
Yeah. Really, it's a few years old now.
Well, regardless of this most recent stuff, I mean, you obviously feel there's a real kind of some new evidence that's come to light through this stuff. I mean, are there cases that would be, you know, within the remit of what Sue has looked at, that for you are also evidential? I mean, I seem to remember in one of a chapter I read of one of your books, Graham, you talked about Penny Sartoru's work and the that as far as she's concerned, there are some of these veridical experiences that seem to.
I think in her research, she focused on patient 10. I mean, I don't want to get too into near death because
tell us about patient 10. Then
that's slightly a different area.
Yeah, it is slightly different. Okay. Yeah, and I think what's interesting is, I mean, here we have someone, you know, okay, I've had dramatic out of body experience, but Graham's really learned how to do it and learned to teach other people, haven't you?
Yeah.
How to do it? And I think, you know, this whole argument about you know, did they see or didn't they see? Takes us away from what I want to understand. Why is it like it is? That to me, the big question that remains, I think we can explain in terms of what we now know about brain function, the construction of self and so on, why the experiences happen in the first place, why the body schema splits and we seem to be up here looking down. Mm. And I've done small studies showing that people who dream in bird's eye views are more likely to have obesity and that kind of thing. But I don't understand where this vivid vision comes from.
Right.
I mean, I think, and we disagree about this, that it's not coming from the world out there. It's coming from things you already know. But why is it so vivid?
Yeah.
And you're able to scan it with, you know, in the way that you are actually see. It's like really seeing only clearer, isn't it? Why? There's lots we don't understand, and that's what's bugging
me. not always seeing clearer.
Oh, it's sometimes muddy and vague, is it?
In my latest work, I'm looking at the visual component in a lot more detail because there's been a lot of assumptions about how vision functions. So you can take that even in terms of, if you wanted to look at it skeptically, I think it's still useful because I'm analysing the phenomenology, what exactly people are seeing, feeling, how it's actually unfolding
itself,
for that individual. Yeah. And it's not, people see, for example, in monotone, duotone, all different types of forms of vision. There's the very, very crystalline, precise vision, but that's not always what people describe. So I'm trying to sort of go into that in a lot more detail at the moment.
I mean, let's talk about some of the brain aspect of this, because obviously Sue gave us a boiled down explanation of this, I think, temporoparietal junction that is the epicenter, if you like, of where these experiences come from. So when these experiments were done to stimulate it,
well,
people started having
that's an assumption.
Something like an out-of-body experience.
What's an assumption?
That it comes from the TPJ.
Oh, no, I think we can say it's a discovery that you can induce them by touching
that's
a
TPJ. That's your
impression. No, we know that from Blanke's research. That doesn't mean...
Okay, well, why do you disagree? Okay,
because I was going to say that doesn't mean that all OBEs are like that at all, but
When I've looked at the description of the epileptic brain stimulation that Olaf Blanke did, as Janice Holden put forward, there was a whole group of scientists who criticised the description because the Swiss patient that they were focusing on within that particular piece of research, the out-of-body or supposed out-of-body experience was very uncharacteristic and very unlike anything described in the literature. So I think there's a lot of people who disagree that it's clearly an out-of-body experience in the context that I'm talking about, and
it's
that many people experience. It's more of a bodily distortion, a bodily illusion, but you can stimulate the brain and all sorts of things can happen. It doesn't mean that the things that people's brains are stimulated to
Would it even be a problem, even if it had been, you know, describing something very similar to your out-of-body experience for you? Because presumably you think something is happening in the brain when you have an out-of-body experience. I mean, it's not a... There's some brain chemistry going on.
I'm saying is I think it's an interesting piece of research, but I think it's a jump to say that that's a pure out-of-body experience.
That was only the beginning, and I think it gave us a useful clue, which has then been followed up. I mean, there's an example of a young boy, also epileptic, because they tend to be in hospital and being studied in this way. But he actually had a spontaneous out-of-body experience while he was in the scanner, and that showed that the same place, the right TPJ, was particularly active during that experience. And he said, my hand's moving by itself, which often happens to him before the seizures. And then he said, I'm on the ceiling. I'm out of the hospital and looking down. I seem to be flying very high. Now, that sounded like an OBE.
But let's take, for example, the possibility, right, that, that let's say that the TPJ had nothing to do with it, but someone had an out-of-body experience and were monitoring the brain, what would we expect to see happening within the brain? We would expect the TPJ to be active or the occipital parietal junction. We would expect these parts of the brain to be active.
To be lighting up.
Whether the active TPJ was causing it or not.
Kind of my point. We're always assuming there's some kind of brain activity going on. It's a question of whether... it's simply that that's the conduit, if you like, for the experience, or whether it's actually producing the experience.
Correlation doesn't prove causation.
No, indeed, right. And nor does what I'm going to say now. But another bit of evidence is that if you take people with brain damage and map where that specific damage is, this is also done by the Swiss team, when the damage is very close to the TPJ, they're more likely to have out-of-body experiences, and when it's a little bit further away, they're more likely to have otoscopy, where you see another you coming towards you, or other experiences, or heautoscopy, where you get a confusion about where you are. Converging evidence
it's got... The brain has obviously a very key part.
Yes, but as Graham says, correlation is not a cause. We can say that stimulating that area causes OBEs. What more we can say from that, I don't know. But what impresses me and what fascinates me really is what this tells us about the self. Because if something is leaving the body and going somewhere at a distance, that means one kind of idea of a self and of consciousness.
Separate to our physical...
Or at least extended from. It might still be connected in some way.
I'm not committed to an idea that something is leaving and going somewhere. It might be, it might not be. I think, you know, my perspective is I think that a lot of the claims you're making here and saying, I think is sort of jumping the gun a bit. I think that we don't know yet.
But would you say, where I ended up there, that there's some connection between the physical body and the place that you seem to be?
Connection?
Yeah, I mean, because if you got the right name of the person by going in the window, that implies there's telepathic sort of way.
I mean, I'm open to what actually... And in your context of talking about schema, I think that it could be something like a construction of self that we're experiencing remotely.
That if you disrupt the normal sense of self that's constructed in the TPJ, this somehow allows a more open view, which encourages telepathy or even precognition or something. You know, it could be.
I'm not saying it can't be the TPJ, but I'm saying that I think that to say that the TPJ is like inducing OBEs in this consistent way, I think that's an exaggeration.
I take your point.
Okay.
But this would be so exciting if it really was showing this.
Well,
this,
indeed it would.
And I keep coming back to the fact that actually we can explain it without that.
So kind of the Occam's razor, with what we do know, and we know stuff happens when we simulate the brain. It's not that much of a leap to say probably the other experiences can also be explained in a similar way. What do you make of this precognition episode, though, that Graham had? He had a vision, I suppose.
Wouldn't I love to have been one of those four people?
Well, I know, but it's a serious business as well, because this was the Soho bombing, I think, that you were having a precognition of. You say you wrote the details down at the time. Hey Presto 5 days later, events transpired that matched the details that you had seen.
Well, two things, really. One, obviously I can't say at this late time. Right. It's a long time ago, and I just have to take his word for it and say I can't know. But there's various types of evidence. For example, all the premonitions bureaus there have been. Now we have the internet, it's a bit different. But back in most of the 20th century, there were various precognition bureaus set up. The idea being that when there is a terrorist attack or a train crash or a plane crash or something, if you collected everybody's dreams or precognitive experiences that they thought they were precognitive and so on, and collected them all up and plotted them up over time, you would find that a lot more, you know, just before the plane crash, there ought to be a lot more people dreaming of plane crashes and so on. And it simply didn't happen. Just carry on the number of those experiences.
But I suppose everyone who did report did have an experience.
Then would say, of course, then they'd go, wow.
Says, and everyone says, oh, goodness, there must have been lots of people having.
Yeah.
I mean, is that the same explanation you would give for, you know, all those anecdotes that abound about, oh, when that thing happened to my sister on the other side of the world, I suddenly felt a shiver go down my spine and all the rest of it. Is it just we notice the hits and we disregard the misses and so on?
Well, I get quite a lot of emails, you can imagine, from people who tell me stories like that. And they say, you explain that. Well, I can't. And I'm not going to just dismiss them all out of hand.
Right.
I can't explain something that happened a long time ago. I can only throw in thoughts like this that make us think about things in a different way.
The most obvious explanation is that, as remarkable as it may seem to that person, it falls into a general pattern of weird things happen on a statistically random sort of basis.
Yes. Except the science doesn't support
that. Okay, so tell me what. So, I mean, obviously,
anecdotes
are anecdotes, but for you, there is an actual science that we can rely on.
The experiments I've taken part in, for example, with Dean Radin, with Rupert Sheldrake. You know, these experiments are looking at precognition, looking at telepathy, looking at a non-local perception, such as remote viewing and things like that. I'm taking part in one at the moment on remote viewing. So when you look at all that research, and I know Sue disagrees with this research, but the point is you have a whole body of evidence from multiple institutions, multiple scientists, and all those people have to be wrong and Sue right for that to be.
Are these researching these, for instance, the remote viewing and so on? Are you saying, as far as you're concerned, it's being done under scientifically rigorous conditions?
It is being done. I think Sue would agree with that.
And it is yielding positive results.
Yes. Yeah.
Well,
I've taken part in them myself, so I know that from direct experience.
And I've taken part in a lot, and I've done a lot as an experimenter as well. There are huge problems. It's so hard because you're pushing at the very typically a very tiny effect size. You know, very little above chance, and as soon as you find a problem with one experiment and you try and do it again and then the effect disappears and everybody's looking for a repeatable experiment. I mean, one kind of experiment I went into, I did quite a lot of studies on remote viewing, but in particular on the Ganzfeld, where all these meta-analyses where you take lots of different experiments and put them together and to show that the whole body of work really does show something. There's been endless back and forwards about that, but I was involved in some experiments which turned out to be fraudulent. And they are still included in the most famous meta-analyses without any reference to who did the experiments and certainly no reference to published papers on them being fraudulent.
You would obviously decry any fraudulent sort of types of
evidence. It's absolutely terrible. It doesn't happen very often.
You know, I haven't encountered anything.
I wouldn't blame it all on fraud.
I'm getting a little bit from Sue here is that there's lots of people out there who really want it.
They really want it.
And so they're willing to sort of...
Yeah.
No. I would rather be a skeptic.
Okay.
Because instantly you have academic credibility. You can, you know.
Oh, no, you don't.
Well, I think the mainstream of academia does not support these
kinds
of things.
Tends to view someone like you, Graham, as a bit way out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas, in my view, the science is actually strong for this kind of research. Mm-hmm. I don't agree. I think Sue's talking about a long time ago. You did even say at one point that you don't consider your own research significant to make a conclusion from.
Well, yes, I have said that. I think you wrote that with respect to Rick Berger. Now, what Rick Berger was saying about my research, because I did my PhD with, 30 or something experiments in, and or chance results throughout many years of work. And Rick Berger said, well, that's because she's misreporting her results. She really got results and she's trying to suppress them. Well, I fought back on that one and said, no, that's not true, because for the first, several years, I was completely committed. All I wanted was to prove to the world that there is telepathy and so on. Yeah. And then I changed my mind in spite of the evidence. I mean, because of the evidence. Sorry, that's a bit... Oh, no, what a terrible slip that is. Wow.
But no, I understand what you're saying. You were as open as you could be because you wanted it to be true.
I did want it to be true, and then it wasn't. But I would always maintain that however many negative results you get, that doesn't prove the thing doesn't exist. There are any number of reasons why I got those negative results, but I definitely didn't misrepresent them.
Hundreds of researchers get positive evidence.
No, they don't. Not hundreds. Yes, they do. No, they don't.
They do.
I mean, if you take Rupert Sheldrake, just think of all the very well-researched criticisms there have been of that, of the dogs who know their owners are coming home and all these kinds of things.
Richard Wiseman, he was very dishonest.
I was involved in Sheldrake's early research. And had a lot of problems with that. I mean, there are not hundreds out there doing it. There are a few.
Let's take a break. We're going to come back for just a final really summation of what we've been talking about. Really interesting conversation, though. I've been fascinated. Thank you both for today. We're talking about out-of-body experiences. We'll be concluding this discussion between Susan Blackmore and Graham Nichols on both sides of this debate in just a moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable.
We're celebrating Wonder Women in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine as the United Reformed Church marks 100 years of female ordination this month. What can Jeremy Corbyn's youth revolution teach us about engaging young people in the church? 50 years on from 1967's Summer of Love, we'll examine what the Jesus People hippie revolution did for the church. Plus, top US theologian Stanley Hauerwas on war, peace and Donald Trump. All that plus much more. Ask for a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable, concluding our discussion on near-death and out-of-body experiences in a moment's time. If you're a regular listener to Unbelievable, though, you'll know that there's a vast back catalogue of shows you can access via the podcast and via our website. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD and MP3 CD, as well as the digital download, too, if you want to access a whole day of brilliant teaching from authoritative Christian speakers from all over the world, then you can go there. Also links, of course, to the Unbelievable book. And thanks for all those who've been getting in touch saying they've downloaded the audiobook now of Unbelievable, the book. It was real fun to sit in a studio for several hours and just read back what I wrote several months ago now. I'm enjoying hearing the comments as well that are coming in from those who are reading the book too. Signed copies of the book, plus links to the audiobook, of course, from the Unbelievable book website. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. Thanks, James Nelson, who gets in touch to say, I've just ordered your book along with an introduction to metaphysics. You're obviously a person who's interested in philosophical issues then, James. Thought I owed it to you, given how much I've enjoyed Unbelievable, to say a very sincere thank you for the show and the level of respect and decorum you bring to it. Too often debates between atheists and theists descend into name-calling or people trying to make each other look stupid. But you always make an effort to understand both views, bring out the best in people and steer the conversation in a constructive manner. You also recommend me bringing on Josh Ramerson, Christian apologist who I have a great deal of respect for, you say, since he's not interested in winning a debate. Instead, he wants to get theists and atheists to work together to find truth. Very knowledgeable about the argument from contingency, which I don't think you've done before. I'm also a huge fan of Matt Dillahunty. It would be great if you could have him on again. Actually, I do know that Matt Dillahunty is appearing in a stage in London with Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris in October. And yes, it's been on my sort of vastly overstretched to-do list to see if I could reach out to any of those three in advance of them appearing on some kind of dialogue on Reason, I think. But in any case, thanks for getting in touch, James. Always lovely to hear from people who appreciate the show because of the dialogues that it brings. And if you want to get in touch about today's programme, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to hearing from you on the Facebook and social media too, at UnbelievableJB.
for the Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you want to get in touch via the Facebook page of the website. All of that available, as ever, from the show page, where you can find links to the podcast too. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Towards the end of the show, a bit of feedback. I'll be telling you about the forthcoming Unbelievable Christian Skeptic Discussion Group happening this Monday on September the 11th, and also one I'll be contributing to next month on Monday the 9th of October. Straight after today's show, you can hear The Profile between 4 and 5. That's Sam Hales speaking to Telegraph leader writer and Catholic Tim Stanley. And next week on Unbelievable, if you come back, then you're going to be in for a treat if you're interested in Christian philosophy. The 2017 Templeton Prize winner, Alvin Plantinger, joins me. He answered your questions recently that you sent in, and you're going to be hearing what he had to say. Alvin Plantinger, probably the world's leading Christian philosopher. So that's a real treat for next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're just concluding our discussion today on out-of-body experiences and how do we explain them. Had a really interesting conversation today that's I've been moderating between Susan Blackmore and Graham Nichols. Sue, by the way, her new book available now, Seeing Myself, The New Science of Out-of-Body Experiences, really pulling together decades of work and research she's done ever since she had an out-of-body experience, but came to be convinced eventually that there isn't anything supernatural going on. It can be explained, especially with modern research, by the brain. Well, Graham Nichols says he's all for research and experiments and evidence, but in his view, it supports the veridical experiences people report of being able to travel beyond their body or experience things elsewhere. He's had those experiences himself, and we've been hearing this conversation today on this whole area. From a Christian perspective, and as I said at the outset, what's unusual about this conversation, for my show at least, is that neither of you are Christians. I do know there are Christians who do find the out-of-body near-death experience sort of results quite compelling, and they think it lends support to a theistic worldview, and certainly is a defeater for a naturalistic or atheistic sort of view of stuff. I don't know whether you kind of particularly are bothered either way on that one yourself, Graham. I mean, first of all, do you own up to having any kind of a belief in God or something beyond our at least natural physical world, let's say?
I generally would say that I don't have... I try to strip away as many beliefs as possible as my kind of angle on things.
Okay.
And I try to look at the evidence, look at what I've experienced, look at what others experience, look at what the research is, and draw my conclusions from that.
You don't tend to try and go beyond that. It's the minimal thing. But even so, I mean, for those who do think that it's sort of flies in the face, let's say, of an explanation of the universe, which is purely reducible to atoms, electrons, matter and motion and energy and so on, would you at least say it goes that far, that there's something more than that fundamental explanation of everything going on?
I think that it maybe doesn't support the more supernatural kind of ideas too much, but I think that it does support some kind of structure that's similar to what people have talked about in terms of religions and different spiritual experiences and transcendent experiences. But I think probably the actual details and structure of it is quite different to what most religions talk about.
Do you use the word spiritual of yourself, or is that, again, a word you try to avoid?
I would, but again, not with any particular supernatural connotation. Right. For me, it's more of an idea of trying to be more benevolent or kind of work on my own consciousness and things like that.
Obviously, for you, Sue, your research sort of confirms your own atheistic kind of worldview that all that does exist.
Well, it fits with it.
I'm not sure that it exactly
confirms it. No, they're rather different views, aren't
That's
they?
Fair to say.
But I think what is really important to me over all these years, what I come to is, this is all about the biggest question that we ask ourselves. Mm. You know, who am I? What am I? What is a human being? Yes. What is a mind? What is my consciousness? What's it all about? Why am I here? Mm. And of course, Christianity gives certain answers to that. Mm. You're here because God made you, which I think, well, we would say that we can be pretty damn sure that he didn't make us in his image, because then all of the evidence of how we evolved would be out. But, you know, maybe there is some God that started things off. I don't know. Personally, I don't think so. But what's really important to me is having an out-of-body experience really throws you right up against, well, what am I?
Yeah.
Am I something that can... It feels so realistic that you have... You are something that's left your body. And yet, as the years have gone by, I've come to the conclusion that that doesn't happen. But I think I mentioned at the beginning that my own first experience of this kind ended up in a kind of a mystical oneness with the universe. I mean, myself began as a sort of ghost floating above the physical body that could travel around, and then sort of changed shape, and then kind of dissipated, and then became a little point of consciousness, as it were, that seemed to be able to move, and ultimately simply dissolved into the universe.
Right.
That was a very long time ago, but that propelled me into meditation. I've been meditating, you know, every day for more than 30 years now, and did lots of retreats and sort of things. And all this changes one's sense of self. And I rather think that that many out-of-body experiences do have quite a profound effect on people, so that their self is less kind of grippy afterwards. I think a lot of our miseries in the world are about... me, I'm so important, I want this, I don't want that, I want to hold on to this, I want to push that away, what people think of me is so important. But these experiences loosen that up in a big way.
Do you find that even you, Sue...
even me.
are regarded by some of your colleagues in, say, science and biology as... Sue's one of those sort of people who's on a bit of a spiritual trip plane thing.
Yes.
Because it strikes me that they might... thing. Is there even a, even though you probably agree on a great deal about, you know, various aspects, do you find a little bit of sort of what's she going on about now when you start talking about meditation and having you know, spiritual experiences and so on?
From quite a lot of scientists, yes. Just, oh, you're a bit weird, dodgy stuff, you know. But there is a kind of movement going on within consciousness studies, within neuroscience to some extent, of neuroscientists and meditators coming together, and sometimes the same person. There are people doing brain scanning studies who are long-term meditators who've had deep mystical or spiritual experiences, and are trying to understand them. And I think this is wonderful.
Okay.
To have some kind of, some people call it naturalistic, spiritual naturalism, or... you know, atheistic spirituality, all sorts of names for it. That's the kind of way I find myself being being pushed along.
And,
or
and
along.
Obviously, even though you believe you can explain out-of-body experiences, you know, physically in the brain, that doesn't mean you discount the value of them for people who do,
Absolutely not. No. And to understand what goes on in the brain is just a small part, but it's an important part, but it's a small part. In the same way that if we discovered in the brain what's changing when you fall in love, which is a lot because hormones are changing, brain things are changing, you know, that wouldn't make falling in love not being as wonderful as it is. And these out-of-body experiences, quite often people will say afterwards, they become less... materialistic, they become less interested in material things, more interested in deep questions and in other people. And so they can be very valuable experiences, as I feel mine was.
Graham, thank you again for joining us as well on the program today. I mean, for people who want to sort of look into this evidence and maybe you know, get to grips with some of the various experiences you've been describing and research that's been done, where would they begin? Obviously there's your books, Avenues of the Human Spirit, Navigating the Out-of-Body Experience. But there's also continuing research being done all the time in this area.
Sure. I think Dean Radin put together a very interesting list of all the most recent research. So if they Google Dean Radin parapsychology list or research list, I think it will probably come up. That's probably a good place if they want to look at specifically at the science.
Do you believe... probably opening up too big a can of worms right at the end of it, but that when we die, our experiences cease. And that's certainly, I'm sure, Sue's view.
Well, I shall wait and see, but you know, I probably won't find out.
That'll be the ultimate experiment, won't it? But do you think we do continue in some form or another? Or is that one of those beliefs that you just don't have enough evidence for one way or the other?
I think what I would say is the evidence is suggestive of it. That's what I'd say.
There's some kind of continuing consciousness.
Past life memories in children, some near-death experiences, not all of it. Different pieces of research like that.
You're open to that.
I'm open to it, and I guess the out-of-body experiences that I've had, especially like Sue was describing, the more mystical, transcendent ones, definitely suggest something like that. I think for me, the out-of-body experiences really changed me in terms of moving me more towards a greater sense of compassion, which I think is very much in line with a lot of the meditation or traditions, even led me to become vegan because I didn't want to be a part of the oppression, exploitation of other living beings.
So it's had all kinds of ramifications for you, obviously, beyond just the interesting scientific research and so on. But, well, it's a good note to finish on, the benefits of these experiences that you've obviously both felt. But thank you so much.
Me encouraged to go on learning more from Graham and sharing these ideas.
Thank you both for coming in. Thanks for the book, Sue, as well. And again, if you want to find it, read it for yourself, Seeing Myself, The New Science of Out-of-Body Experiences. And I'll make sure there are links to both my guests from today's show. You can find that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We've got some of your feedback coming up in just a moment's time. But for the moment, thank you, Sue, and thank you, Graham, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, once again, if you want to get in touch about anything you heard on today's programme, do send in your thoughts. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. That's the email address. facebook.com/unbelievablejb to like the Facebook page of the show. Send me your thoughts that way. And, of course, catch up with what I'm posting on a regular basis there to do with the show and to do with issues around Christian apologetics, theology and culture. You can also find us on Twitter @unbelievablejb to follow me. That's my Twitter handle. You can get in touch that way. Ed, who's a keen show listener, has been on the show a couple of times himself as well as an ex-Christian, and helps to lead the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group that meets monthly in London. Would just like you to know that the next meeting is very soon. If you're listening this Saturday, you've still time to get along. Monday, the 11th of September, at the usual venue of the Summersound Coffee Shop in King's Cross. The title is Historical Evidence for Christianity. The speaker is Jeremy Ledger, who'll address what we can actually know about Jesus when we take a historian's perspective. In particular, the question, how much are the Gospels useful documents to discover the man Jesus? There will, of course, be a discussion between the Christians and skeptics present after the presentation. So again, if you want more details about that, look for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group on the meetup.com website. And I will be, for the first time, believe it or not, appearing at the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group on Monday the 9th of October. So if you're interested in coming along to that, that'll be at their usual venue, again, in King's Cross. Details to follow, I'm sure, on the meetup.com website. Talking about, of course, the show and the book, and there'll be an opportunity to get hold of a signed copy of the book there as well if you're in the London area and would like to come along. Do you mark your diary for the evening of Monday, October the 9th, when I'll be with the Christians and Skeptics at the Unbelievable Discussion Group. I'll give a few more reminders before that date arrives, of course. Thanks to all those who've been in touch with encouragements about the show. Always enjoy getting those. This one from Steve says, just a short note to say how much I enjoy the show. Came across it quite recently and have been digging into past episodes. What impresses me most is the way the debates are conducted. I think dialogue is so vital in our society. Hope it's an example to individuals and churches to engage humbly and openly with those of different beliefs. I would have liked to have made suggestions, but you appear to have covered the important topics with the appropriate people. I can think of a couple of names of people who have impressed me. You may have spoken to them, but I haven't seen the episodes. One is John Stackhouse from Canada, who has an interest in apologetics. Another from the Roman Catholic side is Richard Rohr, a very gracious, spiritually minded man from the States. And there's a topic I'd like to see discussed. I'm aware of divisions and tensions within the church, and these have been helpfully tackled on your show. However, looking at the situation from another angle, I believe at the very heart of our faith, we are one. And my topic for discussion would be something like, what is the heart or essence of Christianity? Be an interesting discussion with the intention of seeing our true unity without disregarding the issues of contention. Thanks for that suggestion, Steve, and both those guest suggestions sound great as well. I'm a fan of Richard Rohr,
Haven't actually had the chance to interview him myself, but it would be really interesting to get him on perhaps next time he happens to be in the UK to talk about his approach to theology and faith with someone else in the room as well to ask him about it. Trish got in touch via Facebook to say, recently discovered Unbelievable as I was searching for John Lennox's podcasts and speaking engagements. What a blessing, an excellent platform and discussions. I've recently been immersed in seeking apologetics resources, and I have a friend who's on the fence and also introduced me in the last 6 months or so in the new atheists or anti-theists such as Sam Harris and others such as the Four Horsemen, Dawkins, Hitchens, etc. Before, I heard nothing of them or those movements, if you will, in my church or in discussions among other followers. Even now, my friends are unfamiliar or seem hesitant to discuss these issues. Yes, I believe we should dive into the word, but I also believe we should know what's being said and spread on the other side and be equipped appropriately. I had no idea of the extent of the movements and information. Anyhow, I plan to send your website and episode list to my on-the-fence friend, but do you have any suggestions on where to begin and in what order to listen to for an intellectually curious person who has been bombarded with info by one side and whose only experience with religion is divisive and punitive rather than a loving personal relationship with Jesus? Where to begin? Well, Trish, I have got in touch with you anyway, but I did recommend, well, in 10 years of shows that are available on the podcast, where do you begin? It's a good question. But you could go back to the edition of the show in May, which was the broadcast of the talk I gave at Unbelievable, the conference this year, when I sort of gave the sort of history of the show and why I'm still a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists, because that might at least be an introduction to what the show is about, its history, and give some context if someone is going to start diving into the back catalogue, as it were, on the programme. Thanks very much for getting in touch. Oh, something I should have mentioned, actually, from an email I brought earlier from James. I failed to read out the last line of his email, the one who said he's a huge fan of Matt Dillahunty and also Josh Ramerson, said, at the moment, I'd consider myself an atheist agnostic, but I've an open mind, and who knows where your book and some metaphysics will take me. I might even end up on Unbelievable one day. I would love to see that happen, James. Who knows what the future holds. Just time for a few emails. As I say, I'm really catching up on a whole backlog of emails that have come in over the summer while I've been on a summer break. Loads of emails on the issue of the Trinity between Glenn Scrivener and Musharraf Hussein. We had that edition of the show on politics. We had my own discussion with Mike Rand last week on the Unbelievable book and why I'm still a Christian, and of course the live discussion we had at Creation Fest between a humanist and a Christian. So lots that I should bring you or try to bring you, but here's just a quick one from Steve Coombs on that question of evangelicals and the difference between how they vote in the UK and the USA. Had an interesting panel discussion on that a few weeks ago. Greetings from Turkey, says Steve. Been a listener for a couple of years now, big fan. Wanted to write in several times. I listen to Unbelievable when cooking or when I'm at the gym. I actually kind of hate going to the gym, but the promise of being able to listen to a podcast gets me there. I just wanted to comment on the podcast on politics. I was a bit disappointed, though not really surprised, that everyone kept repeating that 81% of American evangelicals voted for Trump. I am an American by birth, though my wife is British, and I find myself identifying very little with American priorities and ideals these days. Still, I remember being shocked when I first saw the statistic, and that's because it's an incredibly misleading one. I'll summarise a few key points from an article from the Gospel Coalition titled No, the Majority of American Evangelicals Did Not Vote for Trump. Firstly, exit polls do not capture the evangelical vote, only the white evangelical vote. Secondly, the exit poll conflates evangelical and born again. While almost all evangelicals would describe themselves as born again, not all who identify as born again Christians would say they are evangelical. For example, Mormons consider themselves to be born again Christians. Third, many cultural Christians who never go to church identify as evangelical or born again. The survey asked no questions about church attendance or actual beliefs. And fourth, most importantly, exit polls only tell us about the people who have voted. That might seem obvious, but think about it. The poll shows that 80% of white evangelicals who voted for Trump, but only 46% of white evangelicals who were eligible to vote voted for Trump. In other words, more evangelicals did not vote for Trump or Clinton than voted for him or her. I know many evangelical believers who felt they could not in good conscience vote for either candidate and so simply chose not to vote at all. That's a good, very good point, because it doesn't really draw in the people who said they were going to abstain because they just didn't feel that either choice was a good choice. Thank you for that email in response to that. It's an important reminder that things are never that simple when it comes to statistics. And there are others that have come in on the back of that politics show, but we're out of time. The time flies on Unbelievable. Usually a sign of a good conversation. Hope you've enjoyed today's one. If you want to get in touch again, do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Hoping to bring you some good conversation next week at the same time. We're going to have Alvin Plantinga on the show. Let me tell you about that right now.
You're unbelievable.
Yes, he is the 2017 Templeton Prize winner, a prestigious prize for a living individual who's made an outstanding contribution to life's spiritual dimension. He's one of the world's foremost Christian philosophers, and he sat down with me to answer the questions that you, the unbelievable audience, sent in via Twitter, Facebook and email. So look out for that next week. Just ahead of him officially receiving that prize, Alvin Plantinga joins me on the show. For now, thank you for joining me here on Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking every single week. And do stay tuned if you're here on Premier Christian Radio for Sam Hales on The Profile, talking to Tim Stanley. But for now, from me, it's goodbye.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why my Lowe's Rewards members get a free paint or exterior stain sample to test your look and find the perfect color to confidently refresh your space. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid in-store only, 5/8 through 5/14. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See associate for details. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.